Welcome back to the last part of this series of lectures. And this morning we were talking about the ecstatic motifs. We had already the characters, the pilgrimage, and now the motif of flying. We've already seen some footage about the history of aviation in history's films, and I have talked about the parallelity of the history of aviation and the history of cinema. And from what I've told you today about the ecstasy of traveling on foot and pilgrimage, it is quite easy to deduct why Herzog is also a great fan of flying in every sense of the word. And when we are talking about the ecstatic motif of flying or of flights in his films, I guess we have to discern five different kind of images, and I will give you examples for each of these different aspects. So the first is quite easy. There are a lot of images of planes in his films, and very often then these planes, of course, have a symbolical value. They're not only planes, but they stand for something. One nice example is from the film Where the Green Ants Dream, made in or shot in Australia, and it's about a tribal of aborigines who fight a company who is destroying their land, and this company is destroying or is working on mining, making mines on exact this part of their land where, according to their myth or their legend, the green ants dream. And of course, this is a legend that does not exist, but that has been scripted by Herzog for the Aborigines. And of course, that was in Germany, another occasion where he was accused of exploiting the Aborigines, because he depicts them with a myth that is not a myth of their own. Because in the film the Aborigines have this legend of the green ants, when they see this green plane that you will see now in the image, they immediately take it for a materialization of their green ants myth, and so they want to have the plane, and they get the plane in the film. And do you see the image, or I don't know how to work with the lights here. Oh, perfect. So. So we don't have to see the whole sequence, just to show you this is an instance of when an image of a plane that has a symbolic value appears in one of Herzog's films. Then the second aspect of the ecstatic motif of flying or flights would be aerial shots, so shots of landscapes that are filmed from a plane or from a helicopter. And we have a lot of them in the film Lessons of Darkness, and I will show you these by the end of the lecture. But we also have it in other films. I will, or I can do that maybe even now. Yeah. For example, I mean, obviously, the film about the flying doctors. There you have the word flying already in the title, and it's about an organization which of course couldn't exist without the planes. And what is interesting is, so these are images, for example, from the Flying Doctors film. Could you, which button is it?
The flight to Auckland is over a vast expanse of bushland. Then across Lake Nakuru, along whose shores more than a million flamingos nest.
So we have here these aerial shots of flamingos and so on, and I have told you that Fata Morgana, the film that he made afterwards, is interesting in terms of found footage because it has footage that was shot for this film about the Flying Doctors, it has footage that was shot for the Fata Morgana film, and it has footage that was shot for the dwarf film that was made afterwards. And here is something like the proof, because if you take a look at Fata Morgana, there you also have aerial shots of flamingos, which are clearly from the shooting of the Flying Doctors film, because when he shot Fata Morgana, he didn't have planes or helicopters. So these shots resemble to the film, to the shots from the earlier film. And it's kind of exemplification of what I said about Fata Morgana being composed of footage that was originally shot for different kind of films. Okay, so aerial shots. We will see more impressive ones in Lessons of Darkness. So the third aspect. The ecstatic motif of flying is, of course, the footage of the history of aviation. We have seen a lot of them in The White Diamond and in The Wild Blue Yonder. I have shown you that. Another aspect, of course, is that he, in some films, that he tells stories about, for example, plane crashes, as in Wings of Hope. I've told you that. So this is another aspect of the image of flights, is to tell stories about flights and about instances that have something to do with flying and with flights. And the fifth aspect would be flying from the perspective of a human being. And of course, here it is especially his film about the ski jumper, which focuses on this moment when a human being is able to fly at least for several seconds. And it focuses in the film, I'm going to show you an extract, it focuses on the kind of ecstasy one feels when one is flying. And I think for Herzog, this is comparable to walking like 5,000 kilometers, is comparable to flying in terms of ecstatic feeling. And in the film, he uses, for example, extreme slow motion and zoom to get the impression on the faces of the ski jumpers.
Thank you.
think this is comparable to his diary of his walk from Munich to Paris, where he concentrates in the writing on his inner state and the ecstasy and the hallucinations and the exhaustion. And I think this is maybe comparable as a visual image of an ecstasy through flying. Yeah, maybe three other things about those images of flights and flying. One concerning the footage of the history of aviation. I've shown you this extract of the mockumentary by Peter Jackson, Forgotten Silver, and I think I didn't make that point clear. Of course, I mean, in this film, yes, he tells the story of this faked person, the supposed New Zealandish director who has invented almost everything in the history of cinema. And then what I've shown you is the clip where he filmed another New Zealander who then was maybe the first man to fly a plane. And of course, this supposedly found footage of this incident was completely faked. That was shot in the 1990s and then via digital tools was transformed into such an old footage. I don't know if I had made that point clear when I have shown the clip. Then maybe some other interesting things about the film Little Dieter Needs to Fly. I have already told you some things about it, and in this film, which is the documentary about Dieter, there is also some footage in it, some found footage in it.
Of a shutdown of Laos in 1966 in the early phase of the Vietnam War. I never wanted to go to war. I only got into this because I had one burning desire, and that was to fly. But that there were people down there who suffered and who died only became clear to me much later when I was their prisoner.
So he starts here when Dieter tells his story with this footage, which is obviously from Vietnam War or something in black and white. And then he comes to this footage taken, I guess, from American planes when they napalm bombed the people over there. And this kind of footage appears at another point of the same film.
But from the air, Vietnam didn't seem real at all. For Dengler, it was like a grid on a map. He had suddenly found himself not only a pilot, but a soldier caught up in a real war. But even though it was all very real, everything down there seemed to be so alien and so abstract.
This seems to be kind of similar footage to the other one.
Like a distant, barbaric dream.
And what tells us, what Herzog tells us here, that all is also reminding, of course, of the film Fata Morgana. So he comments these images here from the perspective of someone who comes from outer space and sees this strange landscape down there. This is also a recurring motif. But I've shown you this because in of this documentary, he later, when Dieter had already died, he made a remake as a fiction film with Christian Bale as Dieter, and in this fiction film he used the same footage. I can show you that. I think it's this one.
Thank you.
So this is the beginning of the fiction film with this documentary footage, which obviously is the same as the second that I've shown you of the Little Dieter documentary. And this here you can see it's the same, only with a completely different music. But I think this tells a lot about the fact that Herzog doesn't make this distinction between fiction and documentary. So he always says, I know only films. There may be good films and bad films, but I don't know documentary and fiction. It's all the same. And taking or starting this fiction film with this footage, of course, this fiction film gets a very documentary note or an authentic note. And so this is typical of Herzog, so mixing these kind of categories. And then about the images of flying, maybe one last thing. If you have seen Fata Morgana, also a difficult film to watch. Everybody who has seen the film might know that. And it starts already with a little bit annoying sequence of planes. Of planes landing, to be more precise. Die Schöpfung means creation. So, and you have now 7 shots in a row of a plane landing. It's really 3.5 minutes, just one plane landing after the other. And there is Anton Kass, who is a well-known film scholar in the USA. He's written a whole article on this film. And in this article, he asks himself, okay, what is the essence of this? What is the meaning of this first sequence with the 7 planes? And he has several theories. So one thing is, as you have seen, Herzog calls this first chapter of the film creation. So maybe 7 planes resemble the 7 days of that took creation. Oh God, one explanation. The other one, which is maybe more interesting, is that he says, okay, with this first sequence, the film establishes its own time, a time that is different from an ordinary narration, different from the linearity, for example, of Hollywood storytelling or something. It also almost resembles a loop, only that it's not always the same planes, there are different planes, but still... this is a film from 1917 at the same time that was the birth of video art, and video art has one strategy that is very important, and that is the loop. So, and of course, this all comes from avant-garde and experimental filmmaking in the 60s, and it's maybe important to know that Herzog, as a very young man in 1964, he witnessed a traveling show of American avant-garde films in Munich, and he was very excited about it and wrote an article about this show. And so I think the American avant-garde, which precisely made films that worked against the normal linearity of narrativity, had a huge influence on him. And this is also one of the theories developed in this text. And by the way, this film, Fata Morgana, has a lot to do with, surely with this American avant-garde, but also with absurd theater, like Beckett or something, which was at that time quite popular and quite often played in Germany, for example. There is one interesting other thing to note, maybe, because I mean, at that time, Herzog made a lot of films in Africa, also the film before with the Flying Doctors, for example. And it is interesting to note that in the 1950s, there was a guy in Germany whose name was Bernhard Jimek, and he had a son called Michael Jimek, and they were very, very popular, and their main objective was to save the wild animals of Africa, and they made several documentaries about it. At that time, it was the end of colonial regimes, the birth of the new nations in Africa, and it was a time when the people started about creating those national parks and so on. And one region in Africa where there were that was very and is still today very important for the wild animals like lions and antelopes and so on, zebras, is the Serengeti. And so they were there as scientists because they wanted to find out what size this park would have to because those animals, of course, they had several paths that they used throughout the year, and they had to find out where this path went and so on. And they made about this a film that is called Serengeti Shall Not Die, and that was the first German documentary film ever to win an Oscar in 1959. And so anybody at that time who grew up in Germany knew these guys, the father and the son, Jimek, and everybody had seen this film, especially somebody like Herzog, who was very interested in Africa. And so on the one hand, and this is the theory of this Anton Kaes in his article, one could say that Herzog with Fata Morgana, which is a completely different kind because it's an avant-garde film and not an ordinary conservative documentary, that Fata Morgana is a kind of parody of this film by the Jimeks, of their colonial and paternalistic view of the indigenous Africans that they have in the film. And for example, the Europeans that appear in Fata Morgana, they are not really post-colonial supermen, but very disturbed individuals. So, okay, that may be one explanation, that it's a kind of answer to this type of Africa documentary. On the other hand, I think that these Jimeks were clearly idols for and models for Herzog, because they, and they made it clear all the time, they did not fear any dangers. They took a lot of risks to achieve their goal, saving the wild animals. And for example, the son, Michael, who was 24, he died during the shooting of the Serengeti film. And how did he die? He had a plane crash, because that is the main thing about the film. They bought a plane in Germany and flew to Africa because, of course, to survey the path of the animals, they needed to do that from the plane. And the interesting thing is that that plane was painted like a zebra, black and white stripes. And if you see that plane, I don't have an image, you immediately have to think of the green plane in the Aborigine film, who is supposed to resemble a green ant. And I think that Herzog might have got the idea of the resemblance of a plane to an animal, maybe from that other film from Africa. Okay. So next point: dreams and visions. We have already heard something about dreams and visions. For example, this morning, it's one aspect of the ecstatic truth, revealing one's inner truth with dreams and visions. And of course, also at the first day when I talked about Herzog's urge to get new images, because he says, yeah, these are like collective dreams. We have collective dreams, and I have to find images who resemble these collective dreams. I'm the only one who can find them, and so on. So it's all about dreams and visions. And it's interesting when one hears him saying or explaining these stories about the collective dreams. There is a very famous quote from a German poet from the early 20th century, whose name is Hugo von Hofmannsthal, and this quote is from 1921, and I just read you in English translation what he says. He says, "What people are looking for in the cinema is a substitute for dreams. They want to fill their imagination with images, strong images that bring together the essence of life, that seem to come from inside the viewer himself and that go right back into his gut, because life deprives them of such images." And this could be a quote from Herzog. Yeah, and there are so many people, and they're in their life, in their poor life, they are deprived of the great images, but they carry them somewhere inside, but they don't know how to enter them. And so I have to give you these images. It's interesting because he has never mentioned this poet as a model, but when I've read it, I thought, but he must know that quote, yeah. But it also shows maybe that Herzog, of course, is not operating somewhere in the void. There are other people in the history of film or literature that have had a bit of the same ideas. By the way, what is also important to know is that Herzog claims all the time that he himself does not dream at night. He says he never dreams. So this is why cinema is all the more important for him, because he doesn't have his own dreams. And maybe this is also the reason why in all of his films he creates dreams for other people. So in the fiction films, there are people dream all the time, but also in the documentaries, he says, okay, in this, for example, I will show you an extract of Wings of Hope, this film about the lady who survived the plane crash. And in the film, he recounts one of her dreams, and of course, she had never had this kind of dream. He invented this dream for her.
Has her safeguards against the horror. She has frequent dreams about shelves, cases, and racks, where millions of butterflies are stored away, all existing species of this world. It is, she says, as if I could safely lock away all the airplanes in the world so that they could not hurt me anymore.
And it goes on and on. So this is supposed to be Juliane's dream, of course. It's not her dream. In the film with Dieter Dengler, it's the same. I'll show you the clip later. But first, let me just mention the other films. For example, Where the Green Ants Dream. There you have the dream already in the title. Then, I've shown you this morning the clip of Scream of Stone with the free climber. And there was also this, he was having this vision or dream, for example. And of course, the film Heart of Glass that I've mentioned a lot yesterday, the whole film, because the main protagonist of the film is a seer, one that sees things that the other doesn't see. And the whole film is about hallucinations and visions, for example. And I have shown you the extracts of how he depicts the landscape in the film. And I mean, this is a model for how he depicts many landscapes in other films. And they are sometimes then distorted into kind of inner images and vision-like views of landscapes. Yeah. So, and then, for example, if you take the film Cave of Forgotten Dreams, I really had to laugh when I saw the film the first time in the cinema, because he then talks to a very young scientist who later says that he, before becoming a scientist, had worked as a juggler, I think, or something. And of course, what does he ask him? What do you dream at night? Yeah, and you find this question all the time when he interviews people. So this is a recurring motif. I have this other sequence from the Dieter film. I think it's this one.
You know, many times people ask me if I was afraid, if there was fear when I was shut down. There really is no time. I had to unstrap, I had to drop my fuel tanks, I had to find it, I had to put the airplane in a small clearing. It was extremely difficult to fly this airplane. There was no time to have fear. And then later on, it's just like on an aircraft carrier. 3 o'clock in the morning, you're flying through this monsoon rain. It's really not a rain, it's a waterfall that you're shooting through at 80 feet over the water, 200 miles an hour, trying to find the aircraft carrier. You have only contact through your headset with the operator on the ship. It's total darkness. And finally, there's this enormous bang as you hit the back of the aircraft carrier on your landing. Then as you pull over to the side, as I turned my engine off, and the engine would spin down and go wop, 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 spin down. Then my legs, that's the time when my legs start shaking. It would shake and shake and shake, and I'm trying to hold them. I couldn't even hold them. I would sometimes have to sit in the cockpit for 5 minutes before I could crawl out. And ironically, later on, just before dying, there is no more fear. It's like a dream. It's just like I'm floating along in a real thick medium. I used to pinch myself. There was no more pain. And I thought, is this real? Is this unreal? This is basically what death looks like.
This is basically what death looks like. Interesting. So do you remember these images? Yeah, it's from Invincible, but Invincible was shot. Can I have some light, please, Douglas? Yeah. So these images were filmed in an aquarium in Monterrey in northeast Mexico for this film. And then obviously he loved them so much, he used them for Invincible again. And interestingly, if you see the film The Wild Blue Yonder, it has a lot of footage, underwater footage, not shot in an aquarium, but really underwater. But still, there is the same animal all the time in the image. So he loves it. Image of death or whatever. Okay. Two last aspects. One, romanticism. It's an interesting question that has been asked a lot of times. Is Herzog a romantic? And he would always deny it. He always says, no, I'm not a romantic, nothing to do with romantic. And on the other hand, many people have called him in his career a neo-romantic. So, I think one can access this question, is he a romantic or not, from several perspectives, and I will give you a few examples. For example, if you take his interest or his excitement for traveling on foot, one has to know that traveling, and especially traveling on foot for the sole purpose of traveling without having to go anywhere, traveling for traveling on foot, or traveling in order to feel the body and to sense other things and so on. This is absolutely a romantic concept. This exists since the romantic period. So if you take him seriously with his interest in long distance traveling and so on, this is romanticism. I have looked up a definition of romantic by a German author who writes a lot about romanticism and romantic. And he says that romanticism is the continuation of religion with aesthetical means. he gives that as a definition of romanticism. And I mean, I think this sounds clearly like Herzog. For example, if you remember his story of his religious phases, religious enlightenment when he was 14, his religious awakening, he always says. And so there obviously, according to him, was a time when he became very religious, but then he, I don't know, he decided not to become a priest, for example, but he turned into an artist. So he took, but he kept, and he always stresses that he kept the spiritualism somehow, but he decided to express it as an artist and not as something like a priest or like a religious person. And I mean, related to that, for example, is also his his depiction of himself that resembles sometimes the depiction of a kind of genius, because this is also a concept that has to do with the transfer of the idea of someone holy or a god or so from the religious sphere to the sphere of art, of course. And so he clearly stands in that tradition, which is a romantic tradition. And by the way, if one says that romanticism is the continuation of religion with aesthetical means, other people then said that Nazism is the continuation of romanticism with political means. And this is one of the backgrounds why he was attacked of being a neo-steely, neo-romantic and a fascist and so on. But we can leave that aside now. And also, by the way, if you talk about the transfer from religion to art or expression of continuation of religion with aesthetical means, also the term ecstasy that he uses all the time, of course, is something that comes from religion and is then, by him, for example, transferred into the era of art and expressed with artistical means. So another definition of romantic is given by a German romantic poet from the period of Romanticism, whose name is Novalis, and he said, not in his own words, but I'm resuming what he said in my own words. He says that romanticizing something means to give the base a special meaning, or to give the ordinary something mysterious, to infuse the familiar with the unknown, the finite with the infinite. Yeah, this is to romanticize something. And it's interesting then to see that the philosopher Gilles Deleuze, who has written a chapter in one of his books about Werner Herzog, says that typical for Herzog is that he sees the greatness in smallness and the smallness in greatness. So this exactly resembles the idea of Novalis of romanticism, yeah, to see the finite in the infinite or the smallness in the greatness, whatever, yeah. And one could also say that Herzog's idea of mixing the documentary and the fiction, so seeing the documentary aspect in the fictional and the fictional aspect in the documentary, is then also some kind of romantic idea. But okay, I don't want to insist on that. Another point, of course, is that his treatment of landscape, because in the romantic paintings, landscape mostly is an external representation of inner feelings and images, and so of the complexities of inner psychology. It's expressed by painting landscapes that are then inner landscapes, and Herzog talks about inner landscapes all the time, and this is why I've shown you this clip from Nosferatu a bit longer, because at the beginning he's walking, but then he sits, and when he sits on the rocks and you have this cloudy sky and so on, and then only the silhouettes of the other mountains and so on, these resemble almost one-to-one romantic paintings by the German painter Caspar David Friedrich. And there are many studies who compare some of Herzog's films with the painting of this romantic painter. And Herzog doesn't deny that he likes this painter. And all, you know, his inclination towards fog and clouds and so on. This is clearly, these are romantic landscapes. But then it's interesting that this guy, Brett Prager, who has written a book about Herzog, he's also a specialist for German Romanticism. He writes, and I quote, "No reading of Herzog that embeds him in a history alongside Romanticism should be taken as an assertion that his cinematic compositions are so lovely that one should always wish to step into them and take part in a picnic on the cliffs. Such a claim would be evidence of ignorance both about Herzog and Romanticism. The best romantic works are meant to call into question our ideas concerning the limits or the boundaries of perception." So he reminds us that our idea of Romanticism is often only the kitschy part of Romanticism. And of course, Herzog doesn't have anything to do with that part. But then he explains that for him, the best romantic works call into questions our ideas concerning the limits or the boundaries of perception. And of course, then one obviously at once has to think about Fata Morgana, for example, or so. Yeah. So then Herzog again would be romantic, and but because this is discussed in many articles and so on, Herzog, I just want to focus on the fact that it's really important, because Herzog has so many animals and so on in his films, and of course the way how he sees wild animals or nature in general is not at all this kitschy romantic view. And he has made a clear statement for this documentary about his shooting of Fitzcarraldo, Burden of Dreams. And this element is also part of his own film, My Best Fiend. And I just showed it to you to make the point clear. Where do I have it? Too many clips here. Shit, I have to search it. I'm sorry, just a second.
Challenging nature itself, and it hits back. It just hits back as well, and that's grandiose about it, and we have to accept that it is much stronger than we are. Kinski always says it's full of erotic elements. I don't see it so much erotic, I see it more full of obscenity. It's just, and nature here is vile and base. I wouldn't see it. Anything erotical here. I would see fornication and asphyxiation and choking and fighting for survival and growing and just rotting away. Of course, there's a lot of misery, but it is the same misery that is all around us. The trees here are in misery and the birds are in misery. I don't think they sing, they just screech in pain.
So whenever someone accuses or calls Herzog unromantic, he refers to this. Yeah, he says, okay, just watch what I've said there. I'm not a romantic. And also, for example, in Grizzly Man, here is a very interesting passage that I have to show you.
"And what haunts me is that in all the faces of all the bears that Treadwell ever filmed, I discover no kinship, no understanding, no mercy. I see only the overwhelming indifference of nature. To me, There is no such thing as a secret world of the bears, and this blank stare speaks only of a half-bored interest in food. But for Timothy Treadwell, this bear was a friend, a savior.
So he makes clear that all this empathy with the animals, and so for him it's completely bullshit, because what we see in the eye of a dog and of a bear and so on is it nothing to do with what we think we see and so on. And it makes, he makes it clear in that film. And maybe one last example, because his films, Encounters at the End of the World, that was nominated for a documentary Oscar, that was shot in in the Antarctic, the South Pole, and focuses a lot also on animals like penguins. And one has to know that 2 years before he made that film, the French director Luc Jacquet made a film that was really, really very successful worldwide, The March of the Penguins. And according to Herzog, this French film about the penguins gives a really stupid, naive, romantic view of these animals. And so he has a passage about the penguin in this film that is for me clearly an answer to this other film, and I show it to you.
Well, I've never seen a penguin bashing its head against a rock. They do get disoriented. They end up in places they shouldn't be, long way from the ocean.
These penguins are all heading to the open water to the right. But one of them caught our eye, the one in the center. He would neither go towards the feeding grounds at the edge of the ice, nor return to the colony. Shortly afterwards, we saw him heading straight towards the mountains, some 70 kilometers away. Dr. Ainley explained that even if he caught him and brought him back to the colony, he would immediately head right back for the mountains. But why? One of these disoriented or deranged penguins showed up at the New Harbor diving camp, already some 80 kilometers away from where it should be. The rules for the humans are: do not disturb or hold up the penguin, stand still and let him go on his way. And here, he's heading off into the interior of the vast continent. With 5,000 kilometers ahead of him, he's heading towards certain death.
Yeah. So, maybe one last example. From the film, I've already mentioned it, I think, yesterday, Echoes of a Somber Empire. It's a film about Jean Bedel Bokassa, who in the 1970s declared himself emperor of, and really emperor, his model was Napoleon with the crown and so on, emperor of Central Africa. And he was a very cruel emperor, and he kept a zoo with wild animals, to which he loved to feed living humans. He was famous for that. And in Herzog film, Herzog follows a journalist who had in the 1970s known Bokassa, because he was even once a prisoner of Bokassa. And now that Bokassa is dead and not an emperor anymore, as in the 1990s, this journalist goes back to Central Africa and looks around what is left of this emperor and his empire. And here in at the end of the film, they come to the remains of this zoo, and the only wild animal that is left is a chimp. And the interesting thing about this chimp is that the chimp smokes cigarettes, and they tell us that the drunken soldiers there have taught him to smoke cigarettes, and now he's addicted to cigarettes. And while showing this chimp with the cigarette, he puts on Schubert's Notturno, which is a romantic music. And of course, he doesn't do that to tell us that this is a romantic view of nature, but of course it's more ironical to contrast, to say, okay, this is high civilization, and this is the music stands for high civilization, and on the other side you have the image of what this civilization does, for example, to animals or to the nature in general. And of course one has to think at once of all the stories in literature, for example by Franz Kafka, about apes and chimps and monkeys who come into get civilized and learn to speak and to write and so on. And it's always that they have to discover, or that the reader then has to discover, that these chimps and monkeys and so on are more civilized than the guys who try to civilize them, and are more human than the real humans and so on. And of course this sequence clearly refers to it. And I just show it, maybe. So this is the journalist.
I can't see this anymore. Can you turn this off now?
Right, I think this is one of the shots I should hold.
When you promised this will be the end shot, it will be the last shot of the film.
Yes, I promise.
Of course, showing the cruel sides of civilization and putting some classical or romantic music over it is also maybe a comment to the way one can read in history books about Nazi officers, because very often one is told that they were very educated and they loved classical music, and there are many films, you know, when then the German officer would drink a good wine and listen to romantic music or so, and then he would go out and shoot 500 people or so. And of course, this is a bit a common of the same kind. Yeah, if if one is well educated and listens to romantic music, that doesn't say anything about his character and about his humanity. And what is also very interesting is that this dialogue between the journalist and Herzog, this is completely scripted. That is invented by Herzog, and they have repeated it for 6 or 7 times. So this is not how it really happened, but this is really like the script, yeah, for the film. And this is maybe the last aspect of romanticism, because this Brad Prager guy, he writes in his book about something called the romantic irony or aesthetic irony, and he defines it, and I quote, "Romantic or aesthetic irony is a means of acknowledging the author's presence set against the illusion that the work exists independently of its author. So to seem true, a work of art has to construct something wholly false." This is his definition of typical or romantic irony. And I mean, it really seems like the definition of Herzog's aesthetic truth as I have given it. So here we have come full circle from romanticism back to the aesthetic truth of Werner Herzog. And circle is a very good keyword, because it's my last motif, and you find images of circles in almost every film by Werner Herzog. And of course, the image of the circle is the opposite of linearity. It's also the opposite of rationality, maybe. It's an image of failure, one could say. And there you can think again of Sisyphus, and about the circle of his life, doing like a loop, life like a loop. And when I say loop, we are again at the beginning, the first sequence of Fata Morgana. Of course, it's also kind of circle, but there was also in the film Scream of Stone, this free climber that had that vision, and then it was this circling image, for example. And if you remember, on the first day, I have shown you the beginning of The Wild Blue Yonder with this alien telling the story, and the first shot of him was set against the background of these wind wheels, these modern wind wheels. And one absolutely has to know that the central image of his first feature film, Signs of Life, shot on Crete, was the following. This is the moment when his protagonist goes crazy. It's the moment when he sees a valley full of wind wheels. Maybe I go back to the film The Wild Blue Yonder just to remind you. So it started with this underwater images, and then, yeah. So it's a direct quote of his own film. So, but that's not all. I have more circles for you. For example, from the dwarf film, I think you can leave them out, the lights. Douglas, yeah, because I'm going to show some clips. So this is when the revolution of the dwarf inmates in this educational institution is on its peak, then so, all of a sudden you have this image of this car without a driver going in a circle. And he holds it for quite a while, so it seems to be important for him. It really goes on and on. So, and then 10 years later, when he made the film Strożek with Bruno S., I've told you about this film, and Strożek, as I've said, was also the name of the protagonist of Signs of Life, who goes crazy when he sees the Valley of Windmills. And so in this Strożek film, and this is the sequence before he commits suicide, yeah? I think one could call this kind of music ecstatic, and when I went to see Bad Lieutenant, I had to laugh at one particular scene.
Shoot him again.
What
for?
The soul's still dancing.
So it's the same ecstatic music, and I mean the breakdancer also goes in circles, yeah? And I think this iguana then walking, I mean this is a shootout, and in the end this iguana walks through the set. This is kind of also an image of the indifference of nature, I think, because it's there are more iguanas in the film, and I mean they can do whatever they want. The iguana just cross there and looks with this look of indifference to the world of the human beings. Of course you cannot only shoot objects or animals or human beings that make a circle, but you can also let the camera circle, and the very famous end of Aguirre. And this is also the point, of course, when the protagonist, the Spanish conqueror, goes completely crazy, yeah, Klaus Kinski. So it's often linked to craziness, the circle. Then the camera circles this what is the name of that, this floating thing. I don't know what it is in English. And again, some indifferent monkeys. Give you three more examples of circles. One is not really a circle, but it's a move for actors that is called the Kinski spiral, because Kinski did it in many Herzog films, and Herzog also in My Best Fiend, in this film about Kinski, he explains this Kinski spiral. And it's interesting that in Bad Lieutenant, in which Nicolas Cage plays a character that could have been played by Klaus Kinski, it's clearly a homage to Klaus Kinski, he also imitates this Kinski spiral, which is when you have the camera here, the actor starts next to the camera so that he's not in camera, and then he makes a kind of half circle to come in front of the camera, and I show it to you. So it's not a real circle, it's only a half or a quarter of a circle, but it's the Kinski spiral. So this is the effect, yeah? Yeah. Okay, two more circles. One in the White Diamond, which you've probably seen, and there in the end it's also about a legend, of course, and I don't have a clue if this legend is true, probably not, but it's a waterfall, and there are somehow birds living behind the waterfall, and then there are images of how they circle around it. Quite impressive. So now you can see the circle. God, wait, we don't have to. Ah, here you can see it. Yeah. Very long, but yeah, I guess you get the idea. So this is kind of a circle that you find in nature, and there is another example for this in the film with the ants, where the green ants dream. A circle that you find in nature, which is a tornado, and I guess this is not filmed by Herzog, but this is found footage. But it's also very prominent in the end of the film. It's also a kind of circle movement that you find in nature. A could see the circle in the beginning, now you only see the cloud. But in the center, of course, is the circling movement. Yeah. Okay. Good. These are the circles. Could I have some light, please? So one last thing I want to tell you, because this is very important to know, I think. Werner Herzog is ranting, complaining all the time about the cinema vérité. For him, cinema vérité is evil. He is against cinema vérité, and he does the opposite. Yeah, this is what he really continues telling all the time, all the time, all the time. And he then also explains for him cinema vérité. This is the truth of bookkeepers, yeah, who are only interested in facts. Yeah, and this is evil. Yeah, and. So, what is so important to know is, what the hell is cinema vérité? I mean, cinema vérité is a movement in film history, and I want to make the point and make it clear that when Werner Herzog says cinema vérité, he is not referring to this historical movement. Yeah, because what was that historical movement? That was in the late 50s, all of a sudden one had light cameras which you could take on the streets, which you could use handheld, yeah, and you also had this Nagra to record audio, which you could take on the street, and so you could record direct sound, and so a whole new idea of filmmaking was born in a more amateurish style, in a more direct style. And also, I mean, you have to know that until the late 50s, documentary films were always more didactic films with always such an auctorial, paternalistic off-commentary who explains you the world and so on. And of course, these films, then these cinema vérité films, where without these kind of off commentaries and with more on sound, with dialogues and with a completely different view on the things. And so this historical movement was more or less founded by a guy named Jean Rouch, a French ethnologist, together with a colleague who is called Edgar, whose name is Edgar Morin, who was a philosopher. And they both together shot in 1960 a film called Chronique d'un été, the Chronicle of a Summer. And this is an ethnological study of Paris and of the inhabitants of Paris, including the filmmakers themselves. They are also part of the film as objects, if you want to. And of course, in the film, then they take the camera to the streets and interview people on the streets. And then they invite these people at home, show them the interviews they had made with them and discuss them. And it seems when you see this film today, it seems like, and one has to be reminded that in 1960, television was quite a young medium and of course quite different from the television today, and this film kind of invents a lot of techniques that today are common for television documentaries or whatever. This Jean Rouch, for example, years before he has made this film, he made a film called Les Maîtres Fous, the Crazy Masters, and this film is about ecstatic practices of the Hauka, which is a sect in West Africa. And Werner Herzog has seen this film and he loved it a lot, and it was one of the models for his film Heart of Glass, in which he hypnotized the actors. Yeah, so Werner Herzog loves Jean Rouge, so Jean Rouge invented cinema vérité, so Werner Herzog does not mean I hate Jean Rouge when he says I hate the cinema vérité, because he's not referring to this kind of cinema vérité. I tell you something else, cinema vérité, why it is called cinema vérité, cinema truth, because this is a direct translation of Ziga Vertov's newsreel of the 1920s in Russia, which was called Kino Pravda. One has to know that Vertov thought, his idea was that the objective of the camera could reveal things that the human eye could not see. Yeah, and this is the truth. So it's also, in the sense of Vertov, it's always a stylized truth, because in his documentaries he used slow motion and superimposition and all camera techniques in order to reveal the truth. So Vertov and the cinema truth, which was the model for cinema vérité, does not have anything to do with recording facts. Yeah, so when Herzog says cinema vérité, this bookkeeping of facts, he's not referring to the cinema vérité as the historical movement. And I make it clear with another aspect. For example, Jean Rouge himself, not only Vertov, also Jean Rouge, he worked a lot with interventions and provocations, with stylizations. And this is also why the film scholar Eric Barno, who has written a history of documentary film, he calls the historical movement of cinema vérité a catalyzing type of cinema, because these were people who were not going out and filming what they saw, but they were involving themselves in the reality they were filming, and so they were catalyzing actions. Yeah, so it's not recording the facts, it's involving or instigating actions and then filming them. And it's also interesting that I've told you that Jean Rouge used to watch his films together with the people that he had portrayed in his films, and this is something that Werner Herzog also claims to do. Yeah, when he shot the Ballad of the Soldier, this film, when he was accused to be a CIA spy and so on, he went to Middle America again to show all the people there, even the people that he accused in the films, to show the film with them and discuss it with them. So this is something which is in the tradition of the historical movement of cinema vérité. So, another thing is that cinema vérité, the movement of cinema vérité, is very often called fly in the soup. And this is a direct reflection of direct cinema, another movement, which is called fly on the wall. If to explain you, so in the late 1950s, early 1960s, because of that light cameras, handheld cameras, direct sound, and so on, a lot of different kind of documentary movements spread all around the world. And cinema vérité was the French movement. You had the free cinema in Great Britain, and in North America you had the direct cinema. But there were some differences, and the direct cinema, they said they wanted to act like flies on the wall. That means they wanted to have the camera in their hands and stand somewhere and only record. I'm not here, I'm not here, I'm only recording, yeah? And this is why cinema vérité, in contrast to that, is called fly in the soup. Fly in the soup because, as I've said, they interact with the reality. Yeah, they are not at the wall, they are interacting. So one already sees that when Herzog, and this is the point I want to make, when Herzog says, fuck the cinema vérité, in reality he says, I don't like the direct cinema. If we talk of the historical movements, because the direct cinema is exactly that kind of historical movement that said the camera is objective. We put the camera here, the camera records the facts. The filmmaker is not there at all. They deny this. Direct cinema movement denied the interventions of the filmmaker. And this is the point that Herzog wants to make, because of course he thinks that this is completely stupid to deny invention, because even if you don't stylize like Herzog does, I mean, you choose the camera angle, the perspective, you choose the object that you want to film, you in later in the editing room, you work with the images. I mean, of course, you do something. It's not wholly objective or so. And so I think that the reason why Herzog doesn't say, I don't like direct cinema, and he says, I don't like cinema vérité, I don't think that he doesn't know about these differences. He knows these historical movements, but because the word truth is so important for him, this ecstatic truth that he's after, he chose cinema vérité as the term that he wants to fight, because cinema vérité has this word truth in it and direct cinema not. I think this is the only reason why he chose cinema vérité as his counterpoint. Yeah, and maybe just one clip from Grizzly Man again. This is Timothy Treadwell, who also staged and stylized himself. This is why Herzog likes him. And he also, when he talks about the bears in his film, this guy, he repeated these shots sometimes 12 or 13 times, yeah, like Herzog himself. And here, Herzog comments on one shot.
In his action movie mode, Treadwell probably did not realize that seemingly empty moments had a strange secret beauty. Sometimes images themselves develop their own life, their own mysterious stardom.
And in an interview, Herzog has called this short sequence a piece of cinema vérité. And I think he said it because this is almost like a surveillance camera view. And then the guy goes out of the image. And Herzog says that maybe he didn't even acknowledge that this was a special moment, just filming the nature without anything, with this kind of surveillance camera view. And normally this is exactly what Herzog fights, this kind of ideological idea that there could be something like a purist objective surveillance kind of cinema. And only, I think, only in this moment he tolerates it as a kind of poetic moment or so. And he also tolerates it because the filmmaker himself, Timothy Treadwell, didn't want to do this. It was just one of the empty moments of his filmmaking. Yeah. Okay, and maybe one last thing about it is that with this background, you can understand why Herzog, for example, said about his film Death in Five Voices, which is a film about the Italian composer Gesualdo from the 16th century, he says about the film, it's the pure truth about Gesualdo, even if many things are completely invented. Yeah. So this is the romantic irony of Herzog, or his ecstatic truth, which is his opposition to the cinema vérité. Okay. We have 10 minutes left, then maybe I show you then what I've said, the first sequence of Lessons of Darkness. Maybe just some words about the film. So Lessons of Darkness, I think the film is about 1 hour long, and it was filmed when the oil wells in Kuwait, after the first war in Iraq, were burning. Herzog went there with a pilot, of course, so we are going to see aerial views, and a cameraman, and they filmed the burning wells from the plane. But not only the burning wells, they also filmed the desert after the water with the remains of warfare and of civilization. And these people are a quote, a very direct quote of what he shows in Fata Morgana in another desert in the Sahara, because there also he also shows the remains of civilization that he found there. It's exactly the same that he does there. And and you all, you then again have to think of you know, this gaze of the extraterrestrial on the insulted landscapes and so on. And the point is that at the same time that Herzog shows us these insulted landscapes, he also wants to make the point, or he wants to encourage us to see the beauty in these landscapes, and he also wants to encourage us to see the beauty of burning oil wells. Yeah, so this is very important in Herzog, that he doesn't deny that something which is really a horror and is cruel and is full of brutality can be very can have a lot of beauty, can be very beautiful and can be very poetic. And I have, when I thought about this, I had to think immediately of 9/11, because in Germany another very famous composer, Karlheinz Stockhausen, said a couple of days after 9/11 in a press conference for one of the concerts he was supposed to give, he because everybody at the time then talked about 9/11 in any occasion, and he said, what I've seen on television there, you know, with the planes into the skyscraper, that was the greatest work of art ever in the entire cosmos. And when he had said that, he immediately had to cancel the concert, and he was insulted for days and days as a stupid fascist and whatever. And the guy was burned forever. He could never appear in public again. And he was is a very, very famous composer. And I think the misunderstanding in this case, I mean, I think it was very stupid of him of saying that a few days afterwards in a public occasion. But I, on the other hand, I understand him, because of course, why was everybody watching these images? Because of course they had some strange beauty. I mean, this is that can have some beauty. A catastrophe can be very beautiful as an image. And I think the misunderstanding is he didn't say it as a politician or as a journalist or so. He said it as an artist, as a poet. And the same goes for Herzog when he films the burning oil wells. And when he wants to show us that this has also some beauty in it, he says that as a poet to us and not as some politician. And I mean, this is, for example, I can make it clear by telling you another thing. He made this film Lessons in Darkness also as a response to the CNN footage, because this war in Iraq was, if you remember, the first really televised war where they put cameras on the bombs that they were shooting, and you could follow on CNN, you could follow the whole war. But what did you see on the images? You saw virtually nothing. You didn't saw any of the brutality that was done to the people there, for example, or to the landscape. And Herzog did this film, Lessons of Darkness, as a direct reaction to the CNN footage, I think for two reasons. One is he wants to show the strange beauty of that, but on the other hand, after, for example, he shows this aerial views and these landscapes, he cuts to interviews that he did with victims of this war, with a woman, for example, which who has a son of 5 years old, and the soldiers that came stepped on his head, and he lost his speech and so on. And then another woman had to witness how her children were tortured in front of her, and he interviews all these people. And so, by contrasting these things, of course, he makes absolutely clear that there is something which can be very beautiful if you look at it from a plane, for example. And this is the same with these images from Vietnam. I think he says the same from when you are in the plane and you throw that bombs. Oh, it looks really beautiful. And this Dieter Dengler says, I only thought of the people that I were hurting when my plane was shut down and I was their prisoner. Then I realized what I have been doing in my plane. Yeah. And Herzog makes that clear in Lessons of Darkness. I want to end then this lecture, I think, by showing you the clip of the film. One thing that I have forgotten, can I have some light? Because, yeah, this is also quite nice. He starts the film with a quote from Blaise Pascal, a French philosopher and writer, and it reads, in English, it reads, "The collapse of the stellar universe will occur like creation in grandiose splendor." And already in that phrase, you have it, yeah, that the collapse of a universe can be a very beautiful thing. But the point is, this quote is not from Blaise Pascal, it's from Werner Herzog. He invented it, yeah. And he does that, by the way, in many films. Many of his films start with a quote of somebody very well known from, I don't know, the 17th century and so, and it's absolutely nonsense. It's always his own quote. But he doesn't deny it. He tells that overtly when he speaks about it film, that it's, of course, his own quote. Also, romantic image, romantic music, yeah, as a contrast to what will follow then later. Capital. So we see images of Kuwait City. In this film, he never refers to Kuwait or something or to the war. So this makes clear that this is not a journalistic portrait of the war. Yeah, he abstracts from it. He simply calls it a capital, not Kuwait City or so.
Something is looming over this city. This city that will soon be laid waste by war. Now it is still alive, biding its time. Nobody has yet begun to suspect the impending doom.
And by the way, I've also told you the story of the German composer in 9/11, because Herzog, when he screened that film at the Berlin Film Festival, was accused of exactly the same thing, that he had aestheticized the horror. Yeah. The war. So this is CNN footage, yeah?
The war lasted only a few hours. Afterwards, everything was different.
After the battle. And these images you can also find in Fata Morgana, exactly the same.
Find were traces. Had human beings actually lived here? Had there ever been a city? The battle had raged so ferociously that afterwards grass would never grow here again. Thank you.
So I don't want to exaggerate. If you want to see the burning oil wells, you have to see the film at home or in a computer. Let me just say one thing, that he was, of course, also accused of using Wagner for the sequence, because Wagner was the favorite composer of Adolf Hitler. But that's another story. Thank you for your attention.
So it was the last word, the last lecture.